Welcome to Church Sound Podcast. I'm your host, James.
And I'm Gary.
We're audio engineers, authors, and educators.
With a special focus on houses of worship.
On this episode, we're building a foundation for great audio. Hey, some of you might have noticed, where's Samantha? Well, she's taking a little break and she'll be back at some point. We're not exactly sure when, but not this episode. So before we get started, I want to give a shout out to this show's sponsors. First up, we have Electro Voice, who have been a leader in church sound since the beginning, and today offer the industry's largest portfolio of loudspeaker system solutions for houses of worship of all sizes. Elevate the audio experience with Electro Voice. We also want to thank Digico. Their new Quantum 338 and other house of worship solutions are available at digico.biz.
Well,
so,
James,
Gary, yeah, we're back again.
It is the two of us.
Yeah, you know, we bring Gary on, and then suddenly Samantha's like, "Well, I could get a break," so she's taking a break, and I don't blame her. You know, there's times when you just got to let like life stuff catch up, and you know, ease back on the gas a little bit, and so yeah. We're glad she's getting some much needed mental health break time, and we'll hold it down while she's gone. Her seat will always be saved at the table of Church Sound Podcast. So
absolutely,
yeah. So you were saying you had a nice client meeting last night with some pickleball after.
Yeah, we played some pickleball last night. And you know, I commonly joke about how old I am. And so I will, you know, just continue on that and the fact that I'm stiff and sore this morning. But I have played pickleball now two times.
Wow. And
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's like racquetball without the walls. So the nice thing is you don't get bruised from like running into the walls, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, it's a fun game.
Yeah, I haven't played yet, but there's a park nearby where in the winter it's an ice skating rink, and in the summer they make it a pickleball court. So I need to go check it out and, you know, just see how old I am.
Yeah.
see how sore it makes me the day after. But, I've got some friends that they get pretty competitive over pickleball. It's not a slouchy game, so...
Oh, we went, you know, seven games last night, you know, going back and forth. There was basically three teams playing. So the winner, you know, kept playing. So I played like probably four. Well, a guy actually injured his knee a little bit, was a little sore. So I subbed in for him. So I think I played five out of the seven games.
Whoa.
And yeah, it's definitely competitive.
That's fun. So today, we're going to be talking about building a great foundation for your audio system. A couple of episodes ago, we talked about balance and gain structure, and I kind of gave an overview of kind of my framework for what makes a great audio system, not just the gear and like what you have, but then how you as the operator operate it, and where you should be focusing, you know, like if you're putting the finishing touches on something before you've laid a great foundation, you're not going to get as great of results as if you go through things in order. And so today we're talking about those foundations, specifically what you set up for your church. So no matter who a new volunteer is, or even if you switch out some of the input gear or even your console, at least you're going to set it up so that people have the least amount of difficulty making things sound good. So for you outline note takers, our foundation is a combination of the system design, and by that I mean the speakers, where they're pointed, which speakers they are, and how well they cover the seating area or where people are going to be listening. Then system tuning, which is taking those speakers in the right spot, hopefully, and applying EQ or timing differences and crossover points and all that to make all of them work well together. And then also your console setup. Now, a little bonus that we'll talk about at the end is kind of your documentation so that anybody can come in and easily learn what it is that your system has set up, you know, the standard operating procedures, all of that. But we'll talk about that in just a little bit. So, Gary, you deal a lot with people that are installing new systems. Tell us a little bit about system design and why it's important to get right when you do it. Because, yeah, tell us why.
Well, yeah, there's so many factors that go into that. You know, I like, as you talked about system design, you're talking about getting, you know, the right speakers with the right coverage. You know, in reality, you know, those speakers are going to hang there probably a minimum of 10 years, more than likely 20 years. And so getting the coverage right and, you know, getting the overall design right is just critical. I used to refer to it as what I called the heart of the system. You know, and the heart of your system is your speakers, your amplifiers, and kind of your DSP, whether that's incorporated into the amplifiers or, you know, today it could be all incorporated into, you know, a powered speaker, you know, situation. But those three things, whatever, you know, way that they're made up of amplification, DSP, and speakers, are the heart that's going to make your system perform. And that's going to define what your performance is. You know, the console is going to make it manageable, controllable, and easier or harder to mix maybe, but it's not going to have a significant impact on what that system sounds like. So, you know, I talk all the time about let's get the heart of the system right. And also, as technology changes, consoles come and go. Again, it seems like, you know, speaker systems, you know, pun intended, hang around for a long time.
I like that one. I'm going to steal that too. Yeah, one part of system design that I think a lot of people don't always take into account, often it's seen as kind of like an extra thing, is acoustic treatment for the room.
Yes.
You know, I like to make the analogy, if the speaker system is your race car, your room and the acoustics is the racetrack, right? Okay. So if you took, you know, an F1 racer on a rally car track and, you know, your dirt road, bunch of potholes, yeah, that's still not going to work very well. And often the problems that people are having they're trying to solve problems on their console or they're setting up a multiband compressor to compress this one frequency because something in the room is resonating or there's parts of it that has untamed reflections that are making it more difficult for your sound system to do its job. So, you know, don't forget that the acoustics is a big part of that. And when you can't fix the acoustics, right? So, you know, say you're loading into a gym or you've got an event space that you're renting for your mobile church. Still, at that point, you have to balance, like, where does the system and the room kind of have that intersection, right? So you're making sure that your speakers are pointed in a place where you're not going to get a bunch of extra room reflections and things like that. If you can't tame those reflections from, you know, acoustic treatment on the walls, or it's just not feasible to do, you've got to think about that as well in your system design.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, you reminded me of a conversation I had probably 30 years ago. Gosh, maybe even a little longer than that, but with, Craig Jansen, who's a guy, you know, known in our industry for, you know, system design and so forth. And he was talking about early on in his career, he was hired to come in and do a show in a theater. And he ends up getting delayed flight-wise and so forth and literally gets there right before rehearsal is going to start. And he walks into the room and he's like, wow, this is a beautiful, you know, beautiful room. It looks to be laid out well, but, you know, didn't even have time to check the system, do anything. Basically, you know, went to front of house and started to get busy. And he says, as I'm mixing, I'm like, wow, this just feels good. It sounds fantastic. And he said, at some point during this process, I realized that, you know, I looked up, the speakers looked like they were in the right spot and all that type of stuff, but they probably could have pointed the speakers at the ceiling and it still would have sounded really good because the room was, you know, so well tamed. The room was so good. And when you were just talking about acoustics and that, it just reminded me of, you know, of that story because, you know, you spend a ton of money trying to fix basically a physical problem that in reality is really hard to fix with electronics, if not impossible.
Yeah, that brings up another point is, you know, there's a church here in Kansas City that I've done some work for over the years, and their building was built like pre-1900, right? So 19th century building, and it's beautiful. It's got beautiful stained glass. It's got really high arched ceilings. It feels like you're, you know, not in a queue, you know, like a black box kind of, you know, just dark room. It doesn't feel like you're in a theater. You're in a room that was designed for that. And it was designed for speech amplification and the pipe organ that was there before. But it's designed for speech amplification without any acoustic, you know, any electronics, right? So it's made so that, you know, a person's voice can project to a really large group of people. And that could, you know, and does create some problems when we add a PA in there and try to fit a rock band in there. But another kind of big picture decision that you kind of have to make before you design your system is, are you going to set up your church for, you know, sound reinforcement, which I'll define in a second, or live mixing? So sound reinforcement is where we have meaningful sounds coming from on the stage. And then our sound system adds detail and clarity to those things that are coming off the stage already. As opposed to live mixing, where we try to control all the sounds on stage and keep it as quiet as possible so that everything that comes out to the audience's ears is coming through the sound system. And so you can do one or the other. It's kind of hard to do both well, but making sure that you've got like your philosophy of design clear before you get started, you know, like in that room in Kansas City at Redeemer Fellowship, it would be really difficult to get a PA to cover all the different zones and wings and balcony things in a way that would make it sound natural while people are like matching what they're seeing and what they're hearing, right? Because it's such a large space. It's got such a high ceiling. To add the exact right amount of reverb to make it feel right, if you're just only listening to what's coming out of the speakers, that would be really tricky. So they've actually gone counter to what a lot of churches are doing, and they don't have a drum cage. They've got some shields to keep the drums from getting into the vocals, and they've put amps in the back room, but it's loud on stage. But that loudness just comes into the room. You know, like you feel like you're in the same room as a drum kit. And it's a departure from what a lot of people have been trying to get control. But at the same time, it kind of lowers the skill required for, you know, the operators, you know, like volunteers there don't have to craft the perfect drum mix because they're already getting drums. They just have to like push up enough detail in the drums so that it feels more in your face, or enough punch from the subs to make it feel like people expect. So it's actually made their jobs a little bit easier in some ways to embrace like what the room was designed for.
Yeah, that is a you know, great illustration of, you know, using what you have, you know, because it would be very difficult in that room, obviously, to go in and deaden it, you know, somehow to make that room feel, you know, like a, you know, a black box, you know, church that we, you know, are commonly see now, and would have, you know, great effect on the visual impact also. So, That's you know, that's excellent that you know, you have a church that is using, you know, what they have and using it well. I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine. They were updating their PA. There was about probably a 15-year-old PA, and we were putting in, you know, all brand new stuff. And his statement was, "I'm afraid what I'm going to hear now," you know, because they, yeah, because there's a lot of stuff there that gets kind of covered up, and you know, all of that. And so when you're, you know, talking about using the natural sounds, which I think is great, you know, again, it's probably, again, I'll go back to my age thing, you know, of the garage band, you know, or, you know, I was mixing before in-ears were even common at all. They were just, you know, starting to come out. And so, you know, you had to deal with all the level from the stage monitors, and we had amplifiers, you know, on the stage. And the drum shield was just starting to kind of become like this idea of, hey, we can put this plexiglass in front of the drummer and it doesn't, you know, spill into everybody's microphones and so forth.
Yeah, I came on the scene, you know, where in-ear monitors were like, ooh, that's a luxury. You know, like you were pretty cool if somebody had in-ear monitors.
Yeah.
The amount of noise that used to be normal to contend with. And even I was up, you know, at a church in Iowa updating their stuff, and they were moving from, you know, an analog console with monitor wedges and, you know, a PA in their room to an X32 with, you know, the P16s.
Sure.
And the amount of just sheer muddy noise coming from on stage normally, like it just tied your hands as a mixer, you know, like to get everybody's monitors loud enough so that they can hear one another meant that even with the front of house speakers off, you just heard this big wash of, you know, nasty low mids. And that was, you know, just what we had to do in live sound for a long time was just like, all right, here, you know, it's a rodeo and we're just trying to hang on.
Yeah.
we're trying to get through this and make it clear enough. You know, we don't have the time to, like, you know, mess with all the details and get all, you know, things super, super refined because there's just so much noise coming from on the stage and getting into the other microphones and all of that. So if you're like thinking, oh man, my drums are leaking into my vocals, you know, the in-ears are, you know, so tough to mix, the problems could be much worse. You know, we're dealing with first world problems in our church sound systems. So any steps you can take to make it easier for you, a less stage noise, is going to lessen the requirements on the system to sound, you know, the way that it sounds. You know, it's going to sound good when you're not competing with all that stage noise, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, let's back up a little bit on the system design stuff here, because again, you say first world things. I'll say this first world privilege that we have is there is so much software available now for us to actually do a design for a room and get accurate predictions. You know, not necessarily what the room is going to sound like with, you know, all the decay and everything else in the room. But when looking at the coverage of a speaker system, you know, the tools out there, almost every manufacturer has a tool, or, you know, Ease even has now Ease Focus, which is, you know, a real straightforward, you know, design tool that allows you to do a prediction of the coverage of the speaker system. So when you're designing a system, or, you know, somebody approaches you, James, you know, how do you kind of, you know, look at it? You know, I, again, aging myself, you know, there was a little bit back in the old day where you kind of put your finger in the air and you go, hey, a 60 by 40, you know, box will cover this area. And, you know, we kind of, you know, mapped it out. We may even got our little, you know, right angles and protractors out and, you know, drawn something up. But, you know, we're living in a different world today.
Yeah. Honestly, I point them to somebody else when they ask me because I know like the learning curve on the software and knowing all the different specs, you know, like, you know, if you've got, you know, D&B and you've got L-Acoustics and you've got my, like, there are a lot of options and they all have their own software. And I just honestly have chosen to outsource that learning curve and say, hey, let's take a look at somebody else that does this all the time. You know, my, you know, main thing that I'm doing with churches is helping them optimize what they've already got. Mm-hmm. But I definitely know the value of pointing you to the right person that like lives in system design world and can model all that stuff and can say, you know what, I have, you know, they know the gear well enough where they have a hunch that, you know, XYZ manufacturer is probably going to fit this room well and fit in their budget. And so then they can go and, you know, do all the designs and stuff. So that's definitely something that I know enough to know that I don't know enough to like have the weight of that, you know,
right.
$30,000, $50,000, $100,000 design. I don't want to like take that on and not do it well.
Yep.
So I definitely make sure that I ask somebody else to do that one.
Yeah. Well, what's great is a lot of manufacturers actually now provide that, you know, SketchUp being as, you know, easy as it is, you know, you can do a model now in a very short time. And so, you know, a lot of manufacturers will say, hey, send us some dimensions, some pictures, or be better yet, please send us the blueprints if you have them. And again, because we're dealing in the electronic age, it's pretty easy to push that information around. And so, yeah, even the speaker, a lot of the speaker manufacturers will actually do a, you know, design and layout for you.
Yeah, that's it's crazy how you can get that much information. And then it's, you know, I've spoken to plenty of integrators that are kind of like, they're doing their best. They're serving their region well. A lot of times it's, you know, rural regions where they're, you know, lots of churches that they're able to come in and have a design that works and gets the job done. And then they're on to the next one. But now with, you know, information being so much easier, you know, you can just reach out to professionals that if you think about like 1995, you're not going to find, you know, somebody's phone number and, you know, ship blueprints back and forth unless you had a really, really large budget.
Yes.
You know, so the ability for people to help virtually and get you the information that you need at not a whole lot of money. You know, like you don't have to have the biggest budget ever to get great help in that area.
Yeah. And what is great in our industry, I've always enjoyed, you know, the people in our industry, the majority of people here are here because they want good results. You know, some of them are doing it because they work for a manufacturer and they want to make sure their manufacturer has a good name. So they're like, hey, we're going to make sure we do, you know, the right design. But, you know, I found that in our industry, you know, whether it's being a roadie on a, you know, show or whether it's, you know, working with a manufacturer or whatever, in general, people are really generous with their knowledge and willing to, you know, share and help and guide.
Yeah, that's one thing that I really love about our industry is there are so many people that are approachable and like open-handed with their information. I remember reading Dave Ratt's blog, you know, back in the early 2000s and just being like mind blown. You know, I had done 4 years at a university, you know, learning sound and audio.
Right.
And like, you know, so I had learned enough in university to figure out what he's talking about. You know, like,
right.
It's like I have to have that baseline understanding. But you know, so many people have published and are making YouTube videos or, you know, posting on blogs or articles that there's just so much information out there that's freely, you know, given out. And yeah, if you want like all the details and all the help, you know, that's when, you know, you need to hire somebody to come in and do that.
Right.
But if you're kind of trying to get your head around something and understand the concepts, a lot of people that you reach out to are very willing to share, you know, information that will help you get on your way and make great decisions later.
Yep. Yep. That's for sure.
So next up, we've got system tuning. So we've put the speakers hopefully in the right place. They're covering well, but the system tuning process is how we apply crossovers, EQ, and delay to get everything optimized so that each one of these speakers that we've hung is now operating really well as a unit, and it's matched the sound of our room and kind of what our overall goals are for how big it should sound, how much energy should come from the subwoofers compared to the mains, all of that. Gary, do you have a lot of experience with system tuning?
You know, much like you said about system design, on system tuning, I know the guys who I call and I go to. I love being part of system tuning in that I often get to be kind of the, you know, the objective ears of, hey, this is what I am hearing. This is, you know, doing that type of stuff and offering input on the creative side of system tune. Because, and as I look at it, there's two parts to system tuning. There's a very technical science to it. I mean, setting delay times, that's not subjective very much. You can measure it out. You can be subjective of, do I want to move it a little forward or a little back of how it feels, you know, maybe in the space, but it's very, very much physics of this is where the speakers are at. You know, here's the delay time. And a lot of the system tuning is that where it's, you know, a lot of physics. So for that side, no, I do not, you know, have a smart rig. But I've had the privilege of, you know, being around guys that, you know, do training for smart and work with them on, you know, tuning rooms, as well as going, you know, years back to when the TEF analyzer was around. One of my good friends headed up the TEF division for Crown, and I learned a lot from him, but I never made the investment of diving deep into learning the software and all of that, you know, behind it.
So for our listeners that don't know, what is TEF?
Yeah, so TEF and SIM from Meyer. So Crown kind of started TEF and Meyer started SIM, were the early on testing tools. I can tell you that TEF stood for time, energy, frequency, which are the, you know, three things that audio's made up of. And it was a way to measure those and quantify those in a software-based, you know, albeit I will say, looking at today's software, really rudimentary software way, but it was a way to take measurements of, you know, the time, energy, and frequency of a system and then use that information to set, or what we're saying, tune your audio system.
Right. So it would give you kind of an idea of, you know, what the frequency balance is of a room or a system, and also what's happening in the time domain of what frequencies are hanging on longer, kind of more than reverb time or RT60. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd give you a little bit more information on maybe which part of the frequency spectrum was ringing out more. So then you could make decisions on what to do with your speaker system and then take additional measurements after that. Is that kind of the idea?
Yep. That is 100% the idea. It was, you know, back in the day, we used to call it, you know, we'd pink noise the room, right? We'd put on, you know, pink noise, and we had a little, you know, measure a frequency analyzer that would show us what frequency we're bouncing. And then we play with a graphic equalizer, you know, and again, it was all very, you know, analog and physical, you know, back in those days. Uh-huh. to make those settings. And this was the move into kind of the digital domain, if you will, of, okay, now we can measure this stuff. We still had analog-ish, you know, analog controls at that point. And then now as we moved into digital controls with, you know, digital measurement, it's much more precise, much more accurate, and you get a lot more information.
Yeah, the creative side of system tuning is kind of like the signature that somebody puts on a sound system.
Yes.
You know, like you might hear people talk about a target curve of, we don't necessarily want our sound system to be perfectly linear, where every frequency comes out as the at the same intensity that it came in. For it to sound natural to our ears, there's actually a little bit of a roll off, like in the high mids. So you're losing a little bit of energy the higher that you go for it to sound natural. And then because we like to party, you know, like make things feel larger than life, there's actually a specific shape of a boost in the bass region that makes it feel really big. And so then, you know, to get that thumping kick drum, you just have to turn up the kick drum, right? You don't have to turn up the kick drum and crank 50 hertz. You know, it's kind of baked into the way that the subs and the mains are sounding together. And there's a lot of kind of feeling associated with that. You know, like you've got to understand what's going to work well for your audience. You know, like a church that doesn't do, you know, live music. Maybe you're just a denomination that just does a cappella singing. You're not going to need your sound system to, you know, thump 50 hertz the same way you would if you have, you know, like a rock band with bass and drums and you're after that, you know, high energy feeling. The shape or the feeling of the low end, you know, even if you're maybe even switching between traditional, you know, like organ and piano and hymns and a more contemporary, you know, postmodern church service that has the rock band, your needs for the low end might be very different, you know, between those two. So understanding how to know, like, the speaker system is part of what shapes the sound, even though it's supposed to be transparent, it's still, we make it shape the sound some so that it just makes it easy to sound good when it's loud, you know, when we're getting that feeling.
Yep. And we all have preferences related to that. You know, we all have people we know who are like, oh, I love the sound of Meyer, or I love the sound of L-Acoustic, or I love the sound of, you know, D&B or RCF or Fulcrum or whatever, you know, pick your manufacturer, because there is a kind of that their signature sound, and a good manufacturer, like, you know, those that I was, you know, mentioning there, that sound carries through their line so that it, you know, it's not like their big speakers sound this way, but their small speakers sound completely different. You know, that sound kind of travels through their whole line. The small speaker just doesn't get as loud and have as much as low frequency, but it sounds similar to, you know, the big speakers. And that way their whole speaker line, you know, plays together nice when you do an install. So when you put the small little speaker in the under balcony, it gives that same sonic signature that you have out when you're sitting in the main room where you're listening to, you know, the big speaker.
Yeah, the consistency is kind of what we're after too with system tuning. And well, it's also a nuanced conversation because we're not just after consistency, but we're after delivering expectations, you know, because sometimes maybe people in the front do want it louder than people in the back. So the people who want to sit in the back to have it a little bit quieter, you know, they get to make that choice of, hey, I prefer it a little quieter, so I'm going to, you know, vote with my feet and put myself where it's a little bit quieter. So we can aim for like mega consistency, but that also narrows kind of what we can deliver through the mix and the kind of the mix decisions at that point too. So there's consistency that's a benefit that, you know, keeps you from having like, oh, this spot sounds really dark, and oh, this spot sounds really bright and harsh. How do I mix both of those? Right, that's a pain. Right, that's usually a system design problem that you might be able to try to fix some with system tuning. But system tuning, if you've got the ability to change levels in different zones, that can be a benefit, or it can make it more consistent. Where, like, you know, if your mix is a little bit brighter today, it's not going to blow somebody away, and it's not going to be, you know, and if you mix a little duller, it's not going to be misunderstood in the back, because you've evened it out enough so that tonally still very intelligible, but you still might get some level variation in a good way. One thing to remember with system tuning and EQ is when you add EQ to a speaker or a set of speakers, you're adding that EQ for everywhere that that speaker covers. So if you're trying to fix a problem, say, let's say down in the front row, the speakers are too far overhead and pointed too far back for you to get any intelligibility right there. And maybe somebody very important in the decision-making structure in your church sits right there. And so they can't understand, or they text you and ask you to turn up the singers because they can't understand the singers. It's really because they're not getting hit with those high frequencies because they're not in the coverage of that speaker. If you EQ'd your entire speaker system so that that spot sounded good, or even worse, you EQ your entire speaker system so that it sounds good at front of house, but you don't consider all the rest of the spots, you're shooting yourself in the foot. That's not really the idea of system tuning. You know, I've seen people make the speaker system super, 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 super bright because their sound booth was in the back corner and they're trying to EQ it for how it sounds right there and make it look a certain way on the RTA. And, you know, they ended up shooting themselves in the foot. And, you know, that was, that was not the best sounding service right after somebody tried that.
Yeah. Well, the worship leader at the church that I mix at, I love him because, you know, he says, you know, Gary, I appreciate the way you mix because you mix for the room, you know? And I'm like, yeah. And, you know, so when I mix, I go walk the room during, you know, sound check all the time. I like getting out from behind the desk and I just, you know, I kind of walk the room. What does it feel like in the room? What does it sound like? And when you're system tuning, it's that same kind of thing. You know, you got to make decisions that are best overall for the room. You know, there's compromises everywhere, you know, that you end up making. And so you try to make the best compromises. So, you know, to me, a really good system tuner is somebody that understands the technical aspects extremely well, but also understands the creative aspect, you know, of what they're doing and are able to, you know, interpret what the client, you know, what the end user, what that experience is going to be, and then use all the tools and everything else to deliver that experience for the end user.
Absolutely. One other thing about system tuning is that this is kind of personal preference, but I don't think that the subs should be the absolute shaping tool for your kick drum. So, you know, the kick drum is not the only thing that lives at 50 hertz, right?
Right.
So if you have a really narrow, big boost for your subs at 50 hertz, then anytime any bass player is playing down on their low E string,
oh yeah,
you know, then all those notes aren't even anymore. You know, so make sure that your system tools are not taking it so far in the creative direction that it's actually, you know, coloring other things. You know, like you try to get the kick drum to hit hard, you're also EQing the bass guitar, any piano that plays low, you know, even an organ that comes through, you know, like, and you're doing that, you know, those notes aren't going to be even if you don't have that kind of smoothed out on the bottom end. So that's fun stuff too. One thing that would be maybe a little bit too nerdy for our podcast, but another thing that fascinates me that might be fun for you guys to go explore a little bit is the myriad of different subwoofer configurations that can be done for different shaped rooms. Oh man, that just it blows my mind in like a really, really good way. What all can be done with shaping the directionality of low frequencies. And a spaced pair of subs on either side of the stage is probably not your best bet, just for the record. So I know sometimes that's the only place that they fit, you know, like you don't want to like put it right in the middle of where the preacher's walking, you know, when they're preaching.
Yeah.
But maybe the middle might be a good option. Maybe flown up in the air might be, you know, there's more options than just a pair of subs on the outside. So that's your food for thought for the day. And maybe
that could be a long episode that would get super, super nerdy, but would be super fun. Cause I grew up in the, you know, era of kind of, you know, like left, right subs, or subs ended up wherever you could put them. And, you know, you had power alleys, you had so many issues. And the tools and the design philosophies today, are fascinating and fun and amazingly effective and powerful.
Yeah, and there's a catchphrase I use at the end of all my YouTube videos, and one of those phrases is it's all about the low end. And the full phrase of that is it's all about the low end. When you get that right, everything else falls into place. And that's a truth that carries through in a lot of situations, and system tuning and subwoofer placement is one of those. You know, when you get the low end correct, you prevent masking. When you get the low end correct, people are less bugged, potentially, because either, you know, it's not too thin because there's the low end canceling out, or it's not too thick in like one spot, you know, down the middle of the room. It can be a real, real big blessing to take the time to get your low end right with your sub placement. So maybe that'll be a future episode coming down the line.
You bet.
Cool. So the next thing that we want to talk about, and we've gone in more in depth on this in other episodes, is console setup. And this one's probably the most flexible of, you know, what you can do to get your team set up for success. Remember, we're talking about building a solid foundation for your team to be able to walk in and easily mix, get easily trained. And, well, of all the stuff we've covered up to this point, when you have a great sounding sound system that you don't have to like make mix changes to limp along for how your sound system sounds weird, when you do all this stuff right, it's very easy to take good sounding inputs, you push up the fader, and things sound clear, right? When you're not fighting against the PA, that's a real blessing. When you're getting into setting up your console, that's kind of where we meet like what everyday users are going to experience. And it has to be done logically. And sometimes we got to wipe it and start over, even if we've got, you know, like maybe the perfect setting for this or that, or man, I had a great mix the one time, so I saved it. And I always want to go back to that because it was so great that one time. But sometimes we got to wipe it and start over to get our console set up in a way that's logical, that's easy to use, and both for the way that we control our groups. Maybe you've got DCAs set up in a way that makes it easy to use. But then we also, like the thing that I try to imagine with my console layouts is what's going to happen and where do my hands and attention need to be during the transitions of the service, right?
Yes.
Because I can deal with like, you know, oh, the electric guitars are after the acoustic guitars. Oh, I prefer them before. You know, like there are little deals, but the biggest deals that will make a what I call a sound tech solo in a hurry is when something is on that shouldn't be or something that's not on that should be on, right? So somebody walks up and they start talking into a microphone and there's silence. That's when people start turning around and looking at you. And that's a sound tech solo and we want to avoid that. So how do we make sure that we make that transition? You know, like we're trying to mute the bass player because they're going to unplug, but we're trying to get the pastor and his mic up for either the prayer or announcements or whatever handheld mic is coming up next. Transitions are kind of the place where we get a lot of friction in our workflow. So if you're having to change layers to go between different settings for that transition, that's kind of like a no-go for me. What are some of the things that you think about when you're doing console setups to make it easy for people to learn and then operate on the fly?
Yeah. You know, with digital consoles, it's great because you have so much flexibility, but it's also a curse because you can get yourself into, you know, a lot of trouble. So I aim when I'm working with a team, you know, for consistency. Okay, as a team, this is what it's going to be. And so it's, you know, laid out, you know, pretty much the same, maybe some minor changes you know, but as in the overall flow and layout of the console, I highly, highly recommend making it as standard, you know, as you can. And, you know, with digital consoles being able to save stuff, you know, like I save, you know, compression settings, EQ settings, you know, that type of stuff. But like for, you know, the church I'm at, our team consoles laid out the same for all of us, you know, every week. And that just seems to me to work better, because even the conversations you have with other sound techs and so forth, you all kind of have that same base then. So I'm a huge fan of, even though a digital console gives you so much flexibility, to still keep it consistent.
Yeah, I try to make sure that everybody's got a base scene that we all start from.
Yeah.
And that usually like solves a lot of game structure and like basic settings problems. You know, it's kind of like if I want to solve a problem every week, why don't I just save that to the scene that we all start from? So, you know, it's got basic EQ and compression for vocals. It's got, you know, our routing for all the monitoring and the broadcast stuff. And then when the game structure is consistent, it's a lot easier for, you know, your people to build a mix that's consistent week to week. You know, one complaint that I hear from a lot of churches, you know, leaders, worship leaders, and sound techs is, man, it sounds so different from week to week. You know, we've got different mixers and they've got different workflows and philosophies of how you build a mix. And they've started with their scene that they like to start with because it's got all the stuff they like baked into it. And I liken a base scene to kind of the vanilla ice cream that's going to go on your sundae. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can, you know, you start with vanilla and you can add chocolate sprinkles. You can add rainbow sprinkles. You can, you know, do the whipped cream, you know, make a banana split, whatever you want to do. But everybody's starting from that bland vanilla. And I mean, I still like vanilla ice cream. You know, it's not going to be bad if you just ate vanilla ice cream and didn't soup anything up, you know. That's what I'm aiming for with the base scene, as it works, it comes together. And then one other kind of pro tip is to have a second scene that people can start from if they just need a couple handheld mics and maybe a keyboard and the playback. You know, if you've got a scene that's set up so that they can just hit recall on that and like suddenly all their stuff works. And they don't have to fiddle with all the, how do I get this off? And oh, when I recalled this, the piano mic was on, and so it started ringing, and we're not sure what's this weird sound. And then you start getting phone calls in the evening when you want to be home with your family. And, you know, nobody's got time for that. So, you know, having a scene for meetings is handy, and then having your scene for, you know, rehearsal or, you know, getting sound checks started so that everybody's got the same starting place there.
Yeah, I 100% am on board, you know, with that. There is quite a bit to be said about, you know, consistency. And so, yeah, keeping the board layout, you know, and again, you think about the additional things that we have going on with the board. We might be feeding broadcast. We're feeding stage monitors. We're feeding the lobby. And again, a digital board gives you a lot of flexibility, but with that comes great responsibility because it can fall apart, you know, pretty fast. I this is a couple of years ago, I was doing a production and we had 20 some wireless mics, and during rehearsal I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm hearing like backstage chatter, you know, and I'm like, what's going on? I've got all my wirelesses muted. Well, previously, from some reason, sometime a long time ago, somebody had double assigned that wireless mic to another channel. And then in Digico world, you can unassign a channel and it's still live and active. So it's not on the surface, you know, anywhere.
Yep.
And it took me a hot minute. And I was just like, oh, I'm so glad this is rehearsal. And I'm so glad that he didn't go to the bathroom. You know, those are like the two things that went through my head. At least it was just, I'm hearing back, you know, like it'd get quiet. I'm like, I hear people talking, like, what's going on? And I'm like looking down, I'm like, okay, all the wireless mics are muted. What am I missing? You know, and had to track it down. So again, because there is so much flexibility, you know, you have to be careful. And if you know, one guy's doing one thing, another guy's doing another thing. And you said this earlier on, sometimes you just need to stop and restart, you know, like, it's good. We would occasionally do this, just rebuild our scene. We'd plan for it and say, okay, this is a Sunday. We're going to, you know, bite the bullet and we're rebuilding our scene, because with using Waves plugins, with using everything else, we always felt like we were dug ourselves in a hole and didn't know how to get out of that hole because there was just so much stuff going on, you know, at the mixing desk.
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of times we're MacGyvering solutions, you know, and live sound is definitely a time where you just have to act fast and get something done. But when that get something done and save the day kind of, you know, paperclip, gum wrapper and you know, toothpick solution for starting the jet airplane, that when that gets baked into like what everybody does every time, that's a problem. So, you know, it's not uncommon to need to just wipe everything clean. Sometimes you'll find EQs assigned that you didn't know were assigned. And you're like, oh, yeah, there's a group there and it's got a graphic EQ, and whoa, that graphic EQ is pretty. they made some very nice mountain shapes there.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly you take stuff off and clear stuff out and get it more straight line, so to speak, or there's less things or processors in between the inputs and the outputs. And suddenly, like, your problems get a lot easier to solve because you're not creating them anymore.
Yep.
So,
well, I think we have got this covered, other than I'm going to let you go all bonus on us, because the bonus area here actually is probably one of the most important areas, in that you are, you know, never sure how long you'll be at a ministry or what might change and you move out of town, or whatever else. So give us the bonus here, James.
Yes. So the bonus for all of these is, even if you have the best system design and the best system tuning and your console layout is pristine, you still need to document what went on, where the passwords are, what wireless connection this system processor has, all of the different things that go into that. If you don't document your work, nobody can come in and make fine-tuning adjustments. And they might just have to throw it all out and start over. So I don't know. I was at a church in Tulsa, and we were doing a system tuning thing, and we just couldn't get the password for their system processor because the company that had installed it for them had gone out of business or something. There was no way to get that. And so we had to start over with all of our system processing, you know, for this unit. You know, it was either that or buy a whole new unit, and then we'd be starting over all over again anyway. So documenting things. Another church I was at, they actually could not get into their system processing because nobody had written down the IP address, and there was no way of recovering the IP address if you didn't know the IP address. So we had our hands tied because nobody wrote down the right stuff. So making sure that you've got a Google document or you're in Notion or something that somebody else behind you can come and make any changes. You know, even though you are a wonderful human being, you are not so unique that only you can take care of, this sound system. You need to make it so that others can do it as well. So please, please document where stuff is run. Label cables, you know, have an input list or a drive line list or all the different things to document it, so that if, you know, let's say your spouse, who may not know anything about audio, comes in, you could explain it to them and they could go, oh, this cable goes from here to there and that's where it gets plugged in. If you can explain it to somebody that doesn't know anything about it with this documentation, you have done everybody that comes behind you a huge favor. So keep that in mind while you're working. Don't forget to document things. And if you're going to take it a step farther for your, you know, your console layout, make a standard operating procedures checklist for your people that are running things every week. So if you've got to turn your switches on in the right order so that the console comes on before the amplifier so you don't pop the system, make sure that you've written that down. Make sure that you get the label maker and put the labels on the right switches so that everything gets really clear for anybody else that comes behind you.
There you have it, man. We have laid down a good foundation here.
Fantastic. We're ready to build on it.
Yes.
Well, if you found this podcast helpful and you want to help us reach more church sound techs, we don't really have a marketing budget. You are our deputized marketing department. Would you take a moment and leave a 5-star review and a rating wherever you're listening to this podcast? That'll help us reach more people, and hopefully a lot more church sound systems will be well done and well documented. Church Sound Podcast is part of the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. I'm James Attaway.
And I'm Gary Zanstra.
Thanks for tuning in and have an amazing service this week.